And then, but yeah, be as theatric as you can.
As they prepared for sleep in the inn at Bree, darkness lay on Buckland. A mist strayed in the dells and along the riverbank. The house at Crick Hollow stood silent. Fatty Bulger opened the door cautiously and peered out. A feeling of fear had been growing on him all day, and he was unable to rest or go to bed. There was a brooding threat in the breathless night air. As he stared out into the gloom, a black shadow moved under the trees. The gate seemed to open of its own accord and close again without a sound. Terror seized him. He shrank back, and for a moment he stood trembling in the hall. Then he shut and locked the door. The night deepened. There came the soft sound of horses led with stealth along the lane. Outside the gate they stopped, and three black figures entered, like shades of night creeping across the ground. One went to the door, one to the corner of the house on either side, and there they stood, as still as the shadows of stones, while night went slowly on. The house and the quiet trees seemed to be waiting breathlessly. There was a faint stir in the leaves, and a cock crowed far away. The cold hour before dawn was passing. The figure moved by the door moved. In the dark, without moon or stars, a drawn blade gleamed, as if a chill light had been unsheathed. There was a blow, soft but heavy, and the door shuddered.
"Open, in the name of Mordor,"
said a voice, thin and menacing. At a second blow, the door yielded and fell back, with timbers burst and lock broken. The black figures passed swiftly in. At that moment, among the trees nearby, a horn rang out. It rent the night like fire on a hilltop. "Awake! Fear! Fire! Foes! Awake!" He knew that he must run for it, or perish. And run he did, out the back door, through the garden, and over the fields. When he reached the nearest house, more than a mile away, he collapsed on the doorstep. "No, no, no," he was crying. "No, not me, I haven't got it." It was some time before anyone could make out what he was babbling about. At last they got the idea that enemies were in Buckland, some strange invasion from the old forest. And then they lost no more time. "Fear, fire, foes!" The brandy bucks were blowing the horn call of Buckland that had not been sounded for 100 years, not since the white wolves came in the fell winter when the brandy wine was frozen over. "Awake! Awake!" Far away, answering horns were heard. The alarm was spreading. The black figures fled the house. One of them let fall a hobbit cloak on the step as he ran. In the lane, the noise of hoofs broke out, and gathering to a gallop, went hammering away into the darkness. All about Crick Hollow there was the sound of horns blowing and voices crying and feet running. But the black riders rode like a gale to the north gate. Let the little people blow. Sauron would deal with them later. Meanwhile, they had another errand. They knew now that the house was empty and the ring had gone. They rode down the guards at the gate and vanished from the shire.
Damn.
Epic.
Nice job, Clifford.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so that was the intro for us today. Let's see. Yeah, we got a big episode here. Got to jump into it.
Yeah.
What were you reading from?
This is chapter 11 of The Fellowship of the Ring, A Knife in the Dark.
All right, so lots to talk about today because a lot happened. What are we going to actually talk about? Dude, we are going to, like, we have to haul ass today. We have so much stuff to and we're gonna like end up having like the most positive split ever.
Challenge accepted.
It's not hard to positive split, Clifford.
I know. It's like, but to go fast,
you know. All right, so we got to talk about them leaving Bree. We're gonna talk about the geography a little bit, including the marsh. We got to talk about Weathertop itself. We got to talk about all the songs that were in this one. And we got to talk about the attack itself. And then we are going to get into these Black Riders. Like, who are they? We're going to try to really start diving into them. But before that, Cliff's Notes.
Yeah, in case that summary didn't capture your attention, things are really coming to a head in this episode. A lot of things that have been building up are finally climaxing. So, while Frodo and his friends head to bed in Bree, Fatty Bulger is back in Crick Hollow, in danger. He is trapped in the farmhouse and sees the Black Riders coming, as you just heard. He is quick to escape and sound the alarm, but this is nothing more than a passing dream for Frodo. Strider wakes the hobbits the next morning to show them their bedroom, that they didn't sleep in, ransacked. All the horses and ponies from the stable have been stolen, and the group is at a loss. In spite of their plans for a secret departure, they leave late morning with much attention from the town, including suspicious Bill Ferny and some other suspect characters. They travel for 5 days, making good, hard time through the forest, with Strider at their lead. On the fifth day, they make for Weathertop, an old, ruined fortress with a good view of the surrounding plains. Unfortunately, others have the same idea. With Black Riders approaching, they make a discreet camp in a hollow on the back of the mountain. After Strider entertains the hobbits with the tale of Beren and Luthien, darkness strikes.
All right, so let's jump in. Bree. Yeah, so you already said their room that they should have slept in was ransacked, and then all the ponies were taken and everything. So did you mention, they have to track down at least one, is what Strider decided.
Yeah.
Because they're going to go off-road, so, like, ponies don't matter that much because they would still go slow, but they need one to carry everything.
Right. It's not about speed, it's about packing.
Yeah, and so then the only one that was available was Bill Ferny's, which was like half dead.
If you remember, Bill Ferny is one of those sort of sketchy characters from the bar the night before who slipped out after it was realized that Frodo, something odd was going on here.
Right, well, he was one of the people that probably tipped off other people who tipped off the Black Riders that, hey, Frodo just vanished.
Right, there's a suggestion that there was some sly-eyed southerner. Not much other description, who was really suspicious, who's friends with Bill Ferny, and maybe is giving some information to the Black Riders.
Yeah, so Ferny, though, he's got the only one left with a pony in the whole town, and so then he charges, like, jacks up the price on it, and Frodo's wondering if it's even, like, legit. Like, is this just going to abandon him and, like, you know, go back to Ferny later or something?
Yeah, because it almost sounds like some ironic plan where the only horse left is this guy, probably one of the only guys in the town who they know is their enemy, and they've got to buy their horse from him. But
yeah, and Strider's more concerned that it's just going to die on him. You know, why pay for this? But they have to, and then Butterburn actually pays for it, which is kind of odd, but then it's like, oh, wow, he's actually taking on, like, that he compensates Merry for all, like, five ponies that he lost. So
yeah.
Butterbur
felt bad about dropping the ball in the last chapter, not passing along Gandalf's note at the right time, and now he's trying to make up for it.
He's an honest dude.
Yeah.
Then there's other stuff to talk about, but we just got to keep going. But I do like the quote here. It was close to 10 o'clock before they at last got off. By that time, the whole of Bree was buzzing with excitement. Frodo's vanishing trick, the appearance of the Black Horseman, the robbing of the stables, and not least the news that Strider the Ranger had joined the mysterious hobbits, made such a tale as it would last for many uneventful years. It's funny that they're making, like, such a big show because, you know, Strider wants to be so stealthy and everything. Right. And it's like, it's also a problem that they're making such a big show.
Right. They're basically parading out of town.
But it's also, too, like, you heard it in that Buckland section, too, with Fatty. In this whole scope of this book, they're going to be very minor events to us. But, like, for the locals there, it's like these are big events happening that's, like, following these people. And it's, like, just another classic, like, kind of step with, like, the grand adventure and everything. Mm-hmm. Even though these ones, like, they aren't that big, but they are big for some people, which is kind of fun to note.
Right. It brings to mind, it feels like depictions of, like, some medieval town where, if someone important rides through on a horse, that's, like, the event of the year.
Yeah. That's like Iowa when, like, Ragbri rides through. And then the only other notable thing was they saw Ferny on their way out, and Sam throws an apple in his face. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, nails him in the face.
In the face! In the face!
No! Pretty good aim.
next thing, though, right?
Yeah, so they dive off into the woods. I believe right. It's called Crickwood or Chetwood.
Chetwood, yeah. I don't know if they get there right away, but yeah.
Okay. I guess they kind of wrap around the bottom of Bree Hill. They go through this area that Bree is sort of the capital of. Pippin chimes in to say, our last shortcut was a disaster, so I hope this one's a good one. And Strider retorts, my cuts, short or long, don't go wrong.
Yeah.
Which rhymes.
Yeah, he's
hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Strider's, I don't know, those lines are funny. Maybe you can't say anything more about it, but yeah. So the plan is they're just going to cut straight east. They're going to go straight east because the road actually loops south to make like a smile, you know? Mm-hmm. And it loops south because it's avoiding the Midwater marshes.
Midgewater.
What did I say?
Midwater.
Oh, okay. Midgewater marshes, which means that the hobbits and Strider are going to have to go straight through the marshes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yeah, so it takes them a couple days to get there. I think they get there like the third day, and then everything becomes flat and expansive. And it sounded actually kind of like Tolkien's, like something that they described as Tolkien's army barracks in World War One, Cannock Chase. Look at the one that had the movie, Tolkien in the Great War. They talk about there. Look, yeah. Let me see. There was that one part. Well, so there was the funny part where they're just like, because there was all these midges, which I guess a midge is like a mosquito.
Yeah, or like a little chigger or something, or I don't know what.
But then, I don't know, maybe I'll edit this out because this is so pointless, but this totally, like, they were talking about some evil relative, the cricket that camped around him, the Neeker Breeker things that Sam was calling him. You know, they were unceasingly, like, bothering the hobbits all night. Totally had that experience. I've totally been there.
Yeah, me too.
There was this one time we were camping out at Bass Lake at Owasapi, and... oh my gosh, like there's people there that had been camping for like 40 years and they're like easily worst night of camping in my life.
Yeah,
like there were so many mosquitoes and it was like it was 85 degrees at night and there were so many mosquitoes though that you had to wear like a hoodie and you had to like bundle up so that only your mouth was showing so that you could breathe. But then on top of that you could still hear the mosquitoes like right next to your ears so you could not fall asleep.
Yeah,
and
no, I had an amazingly similar experience. When I was in Sweden, I went backpacking with some friends in the mountains, and we had, an awesome time. And then the last night, we came, like, down out of the mountains into the foothills and camped next to a lake. And it was like that. At first, I put on my raincoat to block the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes were biting me through the raincoat. So I had to put on a down jacket, just like you said, when it was, like, 70 degrees. So I was sweating, and then... we're like cooking dinner and they're just like flying and dying in our food. And then the tent, they're in the tent, they're in our faces, they're in between the fly and the net.
We had a kid who, he just gave up. He's like, ah, screw it. I'm too hot. And so like just took off, you know, just slept in a t-shirt. Next day, literally like 60 bug bites on one arm. Like,
I believe 60. It. I believe it.
So anyways, bad.
that's what we're envisioning here in the Midgewater Marshes. The hobbits are really going nuts here. Sam asks, what do they live on when they can't get hobbit? Which is always a good question. I always wonder, like, what do all those mosquitoes eat when humans aren't around? You know?
Maybe go for other animals.
So they get out of the marshes eventually. And...
Though they were still in the marshes, though, when they that night where they see the lights are flashing.
Yeah. There's something going on in the distance. The sun's already down, and there's these flashes of light to the east in the direction they're going, and they can't really tell what's going on. Like, maybe it's lightning, a lightning storm or something like that.
Strider and Frodo are looking at it, but to be determined. A couple days later, they actually get to Weathertop itself. Strider, Frodo, and Merry are going to go to the top, whereas Sam and Pippin are going to watch the pony and find a camping spot.
What's the significance of this Weathertop? Strider, in Bree, Strider was just like, I'm going to beeline straight for Weathertop.
Yeah.
The whole chapter's all about getting to Weathertop. Why is this so critical?
So it's an old watchtower from the old Kingdom of Men that was there, the Arnor Kingdom. We've talked about that in the past. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this big, huge hill that you can see really far out on. And it's a good rendezvous point, too. So, like, if Gandalf's around or anybody or, like, anybody's good around, they can meet there. Downside is bad guys are going to go there, too, because they know.
Everyone's
they know
going
about
there.
It. Yeah.
And it's a good place for a view.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a commanding position.
Yeah.
But it's also a very visible place. So it's a, you can see me, I can see you, but you can see me.
But, I mean, it was on their way, so that was the first leg of this journey to Rivendell from Bree.
Right.
Let's see, there's the quote here. On the top they found, as Strider had said, a wide ring of ancient stonework, now crumbling or covered with age-long grass. But in the center, a cairn of broken stones had been piled. They were blackened as if with fire. About them, the turf was burned to the roots, and all within the ring, the grass was scorched and shriveled, as if the flames had swept the hilltop. But there was no sign of any living thing. Okay, so... Do you have any architecture comments about, like, what Weathertop might look like? I don't know. You might just have to go off the movie. I feel like the movie did a good job with it.
I mean, I think it's no surprise, as we've mentioned some of these locations, Tolkien was pulling very specifically from the geography around Oxford, where he was living. I think more broadly, a lot of this ruined architecture brings to mind Neolithic ruins in Ireland and Scotland and England. This one, some portion of this chapter specifically brought to mind, if you look up a place called Skara Brae in Scotland, is a Neolithic ruins. It's these kind of curving walls of stone with pathways through them. And then Weathertop itself, I imagine being a little bit of like a Stonehenge type thing on top of a mound. Kind of like what we were saying when we were talking about the Barrow Downs.
Yeah.
Like the stories that Tom Bombadil was telling about the people who used to live here that he witnessed. Something very similar. Those old fortresses, like you can imagine, like any commanding location is a logical place to build a fortress. So There's a cool connection to the geography and the architecture. But one other random thought I had, speaking of Neolithic ruins in the UK, to double back briefly to the Barrow Downs, I think Newgrange is a pretty famous site in Ireland. It's a giant burial mound, but that is a little bit like what I imagine some of the Barrow Downs being like, if anyone's interested in that type of thing. But diverging.
Mm.
So they're on top of this hill. There's these stones. What do they see when they're up there?
Okay, so on the top stone of that cairn that they saw, there's a whiter one it's whiter than the rest of them. And on the marked on it is G3, okay? So Strider makes the guess that Gandalf was here on October 3rd, because right now it's like October 5th or 6th, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
That would match up with the lights that they had seen a couple nights earlier.
Okay.
So maybe there was like some big battle.
Some connection between the lightning and the Gandalf.
Yeah, which is kind of weird that all of a sudden Gandalf's close by, because we didn't have any indication of that for like the past like 8 chapters. You know,
right.
It's just like,
right.
It's,
he's been
Gandalf,
totally MIA. Is he coming to Bree? Maybe not. Yeah. And then he suddenly is ahead of them.
Right. Weird. Strider says, I believe he was here and in danger and he couldn't stay. These scorch marks explain the lights that we saw 3 nights ago. So yeah, so it's like, yeah, there's battle, all this.
Yeah, he reasons that if Gandalf was comfortable, he would have written more. So
right.
He was in a rush and he was threatened.
Yeah, and so Strider says, we're just going to have to make our own way to Rivendell and not count on him. Merry asks, how far is Rivendell? And Strider says, I can do it in 12 days, but for us, it'll take a fortnight, which, you know, demoralizing news.
A fortnight, just to clear me up, is 2 weeks, right?
Oh, yeah.
Dude. So...
Lewis and Clark, fortnights.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of my favorite measurements.
All this old writing, like, it's all tons of fortnights.
I know.
But I thought that was interesting. Strider's like, we're 14 days away, but I can do it in 12.
Hey, he's got long legs, dude.
I know. So they've got a long way to go. They don't have that many supplies, and they've got this not-so-good news. They don't really know what to make of it, but probably not good news about Gandalf. So spirits are not too high right now, standing on this mountaintop.
But that leads into the Frodo quote here. Frodo, for the first time, fully realized his homelessness and danger. He wished bitterly that his fortune had left him in the quiet and beloved Shire. He stared down at the hateful road leading back westward to his home. Suddenly he was aware that two black specks were moving slowly along it, going westward, and looking again he saw three others that were creeping eastward to meet them. The three all dropped to the ground because they quickly figure out what these five specks are.
Yes, for anyone paying attention in the past couple chapters, these are almost certainly black riders gathering on the road at the base of this, basically a big hill, maybe small mountain that they're on top of.
Yeah, and at this point it's like, Tolkien, he is good at setting the mood here. It's like, who wouldn't be homesick in this situation and just feel this desperate? And yeah, this is a tough spot to be in.
Definitely.
They go back down, and Pippin and Sam had been, like, they found the remains of a camp with, like, fresh camp with firewood. Like, somebody had been here a couple days ago. Strider thinks it's other rangers besides himself. So it's not quite evening yet, so Sam just says, like, well, I think we should get the hell out of here, you know? And Strider's like, I don't like the place either, but we don't have any better options before nightfall. Like, we can't get anywhere that's better than
here. The sun is already setting at this point, and they're in a protected location, fairly out of sight, it sounds like. They're in some sort of hollow, maybe there's a little cavern nearby.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Sam has this suspicion that it's not too good.
Yeah, and basically there's a passage that we'll cover again towards the end of the chapter, so we won't read the full thing now, but like basically Strider just breaks the news to him, like, yeah, the Black Riders are gonna come for us. They can't see, but all their beasts can see, and the ring draws them.
Yeah, Mary asks, like, hey, can these things actually see? You know, it seems like they were sniffing last time we ran into them. Strider gives probably the best or the most specific information we've had about Black Riders so far.
I mean, we don't have to go into detail here because we're going to do it at the end. Like,
okay. So,
well, so, but Frodo heard that news, like, oh, the ring draws him, which it's like now he finally actually definitively knows that. And Frodo's just like, so there's no escape. Like, I'm going to be hunted my whole life. Like, are you kidding me? Like, this is it?
Yeah. He's kind of thinking, okay, if I run, I get chased. And if I stay, they come to me and kill me. What do I do?
You know, like, there's no hope at all. But then Strider lays his hand on Frodo's shoulder, and he says, there is still hope, he said. You are not alone. Let us take this wood that is set ready for the fire as a sign. There's little shelter or defense here, but fire shall serve us both. Sauron can put his fire to evil uses, as he can to all things. But these riders do not love it, and fear those who wield it. Fire is our friend in the wilderness.
Sam responds, though, once again, foreshadowing, maybe. It is also as good a way of saying, here we are, as I can think of, bar shouting.
Right. Well, I don't know. These lines here, though, it's like Strider. I think that's the most significant part is, like, Frodo's really freaking out now, but Strider's just like, hey, there's still hope here. We're going to take this little by little. There's a little wood left over here, probably from friends. These friends were probably the past rangers at a minimum, but we know Gandalf's been running around here, or we think Gandalf's been running around here too. So it's like there's other forces besides, you know, reinforcing that theme that there's other people watching out for Frodo, basically. You know, he's not alone.
But another interesting thing here, I guess you could say Strider's being pretty pragmatic, but every sign indicates a confrontation with the Black Riders in the very near future, like tonight. Strider seems to know that and is pretty much like, yeah, let's build a fire. That's that's our plan.
Yeah, I mean,
I understand there's not a lot else he can do, but it seems like he basically knows what's coming. Like, he's pretty resigned to the fact that they have to draw swords, pretty much.
Do you think Strider thinks he can take all five, or is he just hoping that stuff
I don't know
through?
that's like, is he being cocky, is he being foolish, or is he just totally unafraid and knows that he's outnumbered or whatever? It's not really clear.
I think he just plans to pull through somehow, like he doesn't know how.
Yeah, but, that's yeah. Fair.
Just trust him. He trusts to the other forces, the unseen forces.
Okay,
that would be my guess. Yeah.
I also can't tell how scared he is of the riders. He's indicated, you know, they're really dangerous. You should be more afraid of them. But he's also said it's not really their strong suit being in a town with other people. They're best on the kind of empty open road. They can see best at night, not as much during the day. Are these, you know, a fearsome enemy in the right circumstances, but otherwise not so much? Are these things terrible? Are they bad but manageable? I can't really tell how Strider's feeling.
Well, he said in the past that they are terrible. So, I mean, you know, he basically said, like, the Hobbits, like, you guys aren't afraid enough of these guys. But
yeah, yeah. Is he afraid enough, though, given where things are going right now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He doesn't have a choice. And there's no point, you know, like you said, practical. There's no point to freak out, especially if you're him. He's the leader, you know?
True. So, what do they do while they're sitting around the fire?
Well, before they talk about the Tenubial one, we got to talk about the Gil-galad one. So, we got to go back a little bit.
And
so
by the Gil-galad one, Patrick means the song of Gil-galad.
So, we're going to lump these songs together, even though they were at different points.
So when they're making their way to Weathertop, when they're still down in the flatlands, this is the part that reminded me specifically of those ruins in Scotland that I was mentioning, Skara Brae. They're running along a track that's kind of woven into the hilltops with steep banks. They're kind of built up stones and boulders on either side, like they're moving through a hedge made of earth. And Merry's wondering who made this path.
He was wondering that too, because it's like cunning, nice and hidden and everything, which right, I was just like, right. And they wanted to stay hidden at the time, so I was like, I was about to write, wow, that's just too convenient writing, you know. But then it goes on. Merry's wondering, because it seems like the barrel white.
Yeah, it's got a rather barrel whitish look. He's thinking of his terrible experience with the barrel whites. Yeah. Is there any barrel on Weathertop? And Strider reassures them, no, there's not a barrel on Weathertop, nor any of these hills. The men of the West did not live here, although in their latter days they defended the hills for a while against the evil that came out of Angmar. On that note, he mentions that Elendil stood here, where they are now, watching for the coming of Gil-galad out of the West in the days of the Last Alliance, and they want to know more. Out of nowhere, Sam just starts kind of humming.
Can you read the whole paragraph that you just described?
Sure. Strider responds, no, there is no barrow on Weathertop, nor on any of these hills, answered Strider. The men of the West did not live here, and though in their latter days they defended the hills for a while against the evil that came out of Angmar, this path was made to serve the forts along the walls. But long before, in the first days of the North Kingdom, they built a great watchtower on Weathertop. Amon Sul, they called it. It was burned and broken, and nothing remains of it now but a tumbled ring, like a rough crown on the old hill's head. Yet once it was tall and fair. It is told that Elendil stood there watching for the coming of Gil-galad out of the West, in the days of the Last Alliance. The hobbits gazed at Strider. It seemed that he was learned in old lore, as well as in the ways of the wild. Who is Gil-galad? Asked Merry. But Strider did not answer, and seemed to be lost in thought. Suddenly a low voice murmured,
Gil-galad was an elven king, of him the harpers sadly sing. The last whose realm was fair and free between the mountains and the sea. His sword was long, his lance was keen, his shining helm afar was seen. The countless stars of heaven's field were mirrored in his silver shield. But long ago he rode away, and where he dwelleth none can say. For into darkness fell his star in Mordor where the shadows are.
Ho-ho. And it turned out that was sung by none other than
Sam.
Well, so then it goes on to Merry says, like, well, don't stop, you know, keep going. And Sam was like, well, that's all I know, because I had learned it from Bilbo.
And the next portion of the song is about Mordor, which scares Sam, and he didn't want to go any further. Didn't bother to learn the song.
Yeah, and but notably too, Strider tells him, no, don't talk about Mordor. Like, this isn't like the place to do that. Like, you can learn about it in Rivendell if we ever make it there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Gil-galad and Elendil, they were talking about like the Last Alliance. This is where they met up. The Last Alliance is when they went to defeat Sauron, and Isildur cuts off the ring there. You know,
that's they what being the elves and men.
Yeah, the elves and men
is the alliance between elves and men.
Yeah, it's like the beginning of the Fellowship movie.
Right. You know? Right.
I think we'll probably come back and talk about that later. We really just can't spend time on it now. I think there will be another point where we can talk about them. But, you know, again, this Gil-galad poem, immediately, you know, it's communicating that there's more going on in Middle-earth than what we see. And, you know, it's, again, just expanding the volume and the history of this place.
Definitely. For me, this lent a very kind of spooky and rich pallor over the whole thing. Over this whole setting. We got a little bit of an introduction to Weathertop, which has this really, similarly to how I felt when Tom Bombadil was talking about the passage of time in this region, like really melancholy feeling of like these kingdoms that have risen and fallen, and you're just glimpsing them. Like they're just, you don't really know what greatness they achieved or anything like that. You're just seeing these rocks that someone took the time to put there. And then, you know, there's the references to these great figures of the past who have now fallen or are lost. So it really, it's pretty dark, I'd say. Like, or at least you get the sense of, like, everything, almost everything is lost. Like, there was this time of greatness, of great fortresses and great warriors and battles, and now we're in the ruins of that.
Well, it makes you literally appreciate literally every single ruin, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's like, oh, there is a story behind every single one mm-hmm. of these, and it's mm-hmm. sweet. And then you get bits of the tale, you know? And then and then if you're really frisky, you go read, like, the Silmarillion or something to try to learn more, but that only gets you so far, too.
Right.
You know?
There's a famous poem that some of you may have read in school called Ozymandias.
No, we're talking about that in another chapter.
Okay. We'll come back to it. But anyways, that's, I feel like, a pretty good reference for the feeling that this is evoking. And to Patrick's point, like, even if you take the time to dive into the Middle Earth history to learn about this stuff, you can't put together all the pieces. And there's still this kind of, like, lost mystery aspect that runs through it all.
Okay, before we get to the second song, there's just, like, there's just the one funny part where they were talking, like, Frodo was talking to, like, when they're sitting, after they'd gone to the top of Weathertop, and Frodo was just sitting there, and he's just like, yeah, I don't think we have enough food to last. And then Strider's just like, well, tighten your belts and think with hope of the tables of Elrond's house. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was funny. Then they start talking about the actual other song, which we were just supposed to be talking about. Okay, so it's clear sky, twinkling stars, all around the fire, all blankets are out, but Strider just a single cloak, because he's a badass.
Yes, of course.
As night fell and the light of the fire began to shine out brightly, he began to tell them tales to keep their minds from fear. That's noteworthy. Okay. He knew many histories and legends of long ago, of elves and men and the good and evil deeds of the elder days. They wondered how old he was and where he had learned all his lore. Oh, Elder Days, that's Silmarillion stuff. That's First Age. Mm-hmm, we're mm-hmm. now at the end of the Third Age, about 6,000 years later. Okay. Yeah. And so Merry says, tell us of Gil-galad. I want to know, do you know the end? And Strider notably says, I do, and so does Frodo, for concerns him. Because, you know, that's like basically how the ring comes, that's like a major event of how the ring's going to come into possession of Frodo. But Strider, okay. again, notably says, actually, let's not tell that story with the servants at enemy at hand. That's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So they tell him the tale of Tenuviel. So do you want to read that?
It's a long one, so pay attention. Pay attention closely.
I will tell you the tale of Tenuviel, said Strider, in brief, for it is a long tale which the end is not known. And there are none now except Elrond that remember it aright as it was told of old. He was silent for some time, and then he began not to speak, but to chant softly. The leaves were long, the grass was green, the hemlock umbels tall and fair, and in the glade a light was seen of stars in shadow shimmering. Tenuviel was dancing there to music of a pipe and sea. The light of stars was in her hair and in her raiment glimmering. There Beren came from mountains cold, and lost he wandered under leaves, and where the elven river rolled, walked alone and sorrowing. He peered between the hemlock leaves, and saw in wonder flowers of gold upon her mantle and her sleeves, and her hair like shadow following. Enchantment healed his weary feet that over hills were doomed to roam, and forth he hastened, strong and fleet, and grasped at moonbeams glistening. Through woven woods and elven home she lightly fled on dancing feet, and left him lonely still to roam in the silent forest, listening. He heard thereof the flying sound of feet as light as linden leaves, or music welling underground in hidden hollows quavering. Now withered lay the hemlock sheaves, and one by one with sighing sound, whispering fell the beechen leaves in the wintry woodland wavering. He sought her ever wandering far, where leaves of years were thickly strewn, by light of moon and ray of star in frosty heavens shivering. Her mantle glinted in the moon as on a hilltop high and far she danced, and at her feet was strewn a mist of silver quivering. When winter passed she came again, and her song released the sudden spring, like rising lark and falling rain and melting water bubbling. He saw the elven flower spring about her feet and healed again. He longed by her to dance and sing of the grass and troubling. Again she fled, but swift he came, Tenuviel, Tenuviel, he called her by her elvish name, and there she halted, listening. One moment stood she, and a spell his voice laid on her. Beren came, and doom fell on Tenuviel, that in his arms lay glistening. As Beren looked into her eyes, within the shadow of her hair, the trembling starlight of the skies he saw there mirrored shimmering. Tinuviel the elven fair, immortal maiden, elven wise, about him cast her shadowy hair and arms like silver glimmering. Long was the way that fate them bore o'er stony mountains gold and grey, through halls of iron and darkling door and woods of nightshade morrowless. The sundering seas between them lay, and yet at last they met once more. And long ago they passed away in the forest singing sorrowless.
Nice. Strider goes on to say that song was in the mode called Antetherin among the elves, but it's hard to render in our common speech, and this is just a rough echo of it. So that almost sounds like this is like their version of either, I'm going to take two guesses, like that Antetherin is either like epic verse or like the romantic sonnet kind of verse stuff.
Okay, you know? Interesting.
So we're talking either Homer or Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you
mm-hmm.
know, Homer wrote in the epic style, which means you have to use what meter?
I can't remember.
Dactylic hexameter, Clifford?
Oh, damn.
Of course.
You were the Greek-Roman student. For me.
So, I was listening to something about somebody that was talking. It was another podcast where they were talking about epic verse and they didn't know what it was. And so they just said like, oh, dactylic hexameter. That's probably about some six winged dinosaur, but whatever. Let's keep going. Uh-huh. I don't know what it is, but yeah. And there's Shakespeare and he wrote in what?
Iambic pentameter.
Oh, look at that.
I know. That one's been hammered in across years and years of literature classes.
Are you sure? Did I give you that? Or did I?
No, I knew that. That's one that I feel like I've gotten quizzed on so many times.
Okay.
Dactylic hexameter, though. That's a new one for me.
Yeah, so like the first word's about like what syllables you stress or whatever.
Right.
So I don't remember how that works. But then I think the hexameter means there's gonna be six syllables in a line. Pentameter, five syllables in a line, I think. Definitely six and five are involved.
Yeah. Hex is six and pentameter is five.
Yeah. Okay, so the actual song itself, we're not gonna talk about that much because we are gonna do an entire special on Beren and Lúthien for this occasion. Should come out within a couple days after this episode.
Cool.
Ideally. there was the line here. As Strider was speaking, they watched his eager face. Hold on. Let me make sure.
Well, while you're looking at that, I know that was a pretty long poem to read in the middle of an episode, but I think it's a nice reminder of like how impressive of a concoction this is. Like, that's just like a full-blown poem that Tolkien wrote just to stick in the middle of this episode as an auxiliary story that was being told by one of the characters. Like that's not even our plot, you know. That's that's effectively just a sidebar story, and he composed a pretty complex, lengthy poem about this story, which you know ties back to the Silmarillion and it's part of this larger world. But that alone is an impressive feat. So I think it's worth taking stock of that.
Agreed, and I don't want to diminish it, but this is like the crown jewel of the Silmarillion. Like this is that story, and he had been working on this story for over 20 years at this point.
Okay.
So
okay.
So then after that story, though, you know, because that was basically just kind of their meeting. I mean, I don't want to talk about it much, but that was basically mostly just about when they met.
Right.
And so like the whole saga goes on like much longer, and Strider starts going through like all the details of it.
Yeah.
You know, like working his way through. Now we're not going to talk about him because that's a spoiler for our episode that's coming on. But he like, you know, he's blowing through like trucking through the plot and he comes down and then ends up connecting it to Elrond because it's like, well, Elrond's kin of these people.
And it's also Elrond is the only one who knows the full story and the way it's meant to be told or something like that.
And then there's the quote here. As Strider was speaking, they watched his strange, eager face, dimly lit in the red glow of the wood fire. His eyes shone, and his voice was rich and deep. Above him was a black, starry night. Suddenly, a pale light appeared over the crown of Weathertop behind him. The waxing moon was climbing slowly above the hill that overshadowed them, and the stars above the hilltop faded. So, again, like, blows through that whole plot. You got, like, this just epic setting to tell, like, an epic story like this. But who does he sound like?
I don't know. Help me out.
He sounds like us. Like, this is exactly how we've been handling.
I was going to say that I was actually going to comment the way that he presents the stuff to the hobbits is actually, like, he's being deliberately educational. Like, he's
right.
He's saying, okay, so that was a complex poem with a lot of words, but what they were talking about was actually X, Y, and Z. And let me break it down for you. This is a reference to this. These characters are doing this. It's like he's being very deliberately, educational. Like he's trying to teach the young hobbits about the history of the world or something like that, which is kind of cool.
Right. Well, so, all right. So going off that directly too, that is not what Bombadil was doing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Bombadil was just going through it like willy-nilly and just like, whoa, that was cool. No idea what it means.
Right. Bombadil just like quickly hit rewind on everything that he's seen in all of time, and the hobbits are like, oh my god, am I dreaming right now? I don't really know what to make sense, how to make sense of all this.
Yeah.
This is a very different translation of the oral tradition, passing the knowledge down.
And this is what we try to do on this show whenever we can. Like, whenever I can reference the Silmarillion, I do it. And it was because I was inspired by, like, probably this specific passage. And it's like, I feel like this is the best way to cover the Silmarillion. And that's why we're doing it like this.
I strive to be like Tom Bombadil and just unload random references. No, I'm just joking.
Clifford, I feel like that's not in your personality. I know. It's just to willy-nilly unload like that. Okay, got some book notes from this, too.
Okay.
Fleming Rutledge, who, you know, we rely on heavily, she says this is one of Tolkien's favorite themes, you know, like this basically passing down tradition here. She says, truth, he passionately believed, was embodied in stories and tales handed down through generations. He felt, therefore, that it was necessary not only to know history, but also to cherish mythology as a key to understanding. Indeed, the two are often intertwined. Therefore, it is significant when the hobbits learn that Strider is learned in old lore. Communal memory for Tolkien, as for Christians, is a central human responsibility. Forgetting is a deprivation and indeed a mortal sin, as the Hebrew prophets repeatedly attested. Okay, those who can remember, therefore, are held in high esteem throughout Lord of the Rings. This is true. This also reminds me, too, of we talked about way back in the early chapters of The Hobbit. This sounds just like the Grimm brothers preserving all the fairy tales and the Grimm's fairy tales. Mm-hmm. You know, like that was all that was left. They were probably, some of them were probably grand stories, but then they just got downed.
Demoted. How do you say
that? Yeah, demoted down to just nursery tales, right? Yeah. But it's like they were trying to preserve something more. And so it's like, right. And so all philologists like completely value this, the handing down of the tradition of the stories.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to pay attention to in reference to, I guess, some of the townspeople that we've come across, whether it's in the Shire or in Buckland or in Bree, where there's kind of, I mean, maybe it's like a little bit stereotypical or something, but these people who have these like kind of sad, mean, dull lives with very little connection to the outside or to the past are these like very minor, subservient, passive characters in the story, like the people in Bree. Even Butterbur, who's like better among them, he's respected in part because he knows some of the old stories and he knows Gandalf.
Right.
Almost every character of note or of importance, both in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, that we've met so far, is one that like knows their history really well or has, you know, a very like understands their connection to the past, which is an interesting I guess it's interesting to read the story from that angle, to see it as like the importance of characters has to do with how connected they are to the larger history and narrative.
Right. Last notes on this section from like a authorship perspective. You know, all these references, he starts giving all these references, but lots of times they get cut off, you know, like Aragorn didn't at all tell the full story of Beren and Lúthien. He, you know, he deliberately cut off the Gil-galad story twice. And there's been other stuff in the past, like Gandalf's been, I don't know, Gandalf's always clouded, you could say, or like Gildor, you know, he was didn't give a straight answer ever in everything. So all this stuff, its job in the context of the story is basically just to whet your appetite and, you know, provide, I don't know, more perspective, I guess.
Mm-hmm. The creation of a mystique.
The Queen of Light took her vow, and then she turned to gold.
Meanwhile, all seemed quiet and still, but Frodo felt a cold dread creeping over his heart now that Strider was no longer speaking.
He huddled I know I'm ruining your like epic detailing of the scene, but I gotta note this. This is a good catch by me. You're not gonna hear these kinds of catches anywhere else. All right. It says Sam and Merry got up and walked away from the fire. This is after Strider finishes telling his story.
Uh-huh.
Why would you get up to walk away from the fire on this night with those enemies around? Is this the discreet 1940s way to say you got to go pee?
Maybe. That would make sense.
I think it is. There's no reason to get up, and it's cold. There's no reason to like, oh, I just want to go for a stretch. No, you don't.
Yeah. That's fair. That's a great point.
Yeah. Okay. Well, keep going.
On the flip side, though, yeah, whether they're peeing or not, that's a... It's pretty reasonable that people get up after the end of a long story next to a fire.
Well, all right, we're going to get into it in a second here, but like Aragorn stopping the speaking, it's almost like that, I mean, you know, he had to stop, you know, because the story's over, but like that actually affected them because as soon as they're done with that, then danger comes. So it's almost like while he was telling the story, they were protected.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go through this attack.
All seemed quiet and still. But Frodo felt a cold dread creeping over his heart now that Strider was no longer speaking. He huddled closer to the fire. At that moment, Sam came running back from the edge of the dell.
Okay, so running back from the edge of the dell, that's pretty far distance, right? So that might be number two as opposed to just number one.
Or he's just very polite. Like, Tolkien's too polite to say Sam went to go take a leak.
Hobbits are lazy. I don't think so.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, Sam goes on, I durst go outside this dell for any money. Something's creeping up the slope.
Something was creeping up the slope.
Right. And then Frodo says, but did you see anything?
No, sir. I saw nothing, but I didn't stop to look.
But Merry thought he saw something, two or three black shapes coming up.
Mm-hmm. They seem to be moving this way. And so Strider is like, okay, battle plan. Close to the fire, faces outwards. Get some longer sticks ready in your hands.
Yeah, presumably the sticks are going to be on fire.
Yeah, or they're makeshift spears, or who knows.
Well, they already have swords, so... Like,
yeah, that's true.
For a breathless time they sat there, silent and alert, with their backs turned to the wood fire, each gazing into the shadows that encircled them. Nothing happened. There was no sound or movement in the night. Frodo stirred, feeling that he must break the silence. He longed to shout out loud, but Strider still said, hush, and then Pippin said, what's that? And so then you want to read...
Over the lip of the little dell, on the side away from the hill, they felt, rather than saw, a shadow rise, one shadow or more than one. They strained their eyes, and the shadows seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope, looking down on them. So black were they that they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as a venomous breath, and felt a thin, piercing chill. Then the shape slowly advanced.
Okay, so I think at this point, you know, like last chapter when we heard about the one that attacked Merry, like I was pretty confused. It's like, well, were they wearing the cloaks? Because you could probably see them pretty easily if they had the cloaks.
Right.
If you know like this story, if they don't wear the cloaks, you know the story. Yeah, I'm not going to spoil that part. But I think at this point, it really doesn't actually matter whether they're wearing the cloaks or not. Because, you know, because of these lines here, it's like they seem like a black hole just like sucking in all light around them, you know, right. Like they're just pure, like big, huge shadows here. But then again, I think they are wearing the cloaks because of lines that are coming up here.
Terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. Sam shrank to Frodo's side. Frodo was hardly less terrified than his companions. He was quaking as if he was bitter cold, but his terror was swallowed up in a sudden temptation to put on the ring. The desire to do this laid hold of him, and he could think of nothing else. Did not forget the barrow, nor the message of Gandalf, but something seemed to be compelling him to disregard all warnings, and he longed to yield. Not with the hope of escape, or of doing anything, either good or bad, he simply felt that he must take the ring and put it on his finger. He could not speak. He felt Sam looking at him, as if he knew that his master was in some great trouble, but he could not turn towards him. He shut his eyes and struggled for a while, but resistance became unbearable, and at last he slowly drew out the chain and slipped the ring on the forefinger of his left hand.
Immediately, though everything else remained as before, dim and dark, the shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of the dell, three advancing. In their white face burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helms of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell upon him and pierced him as they rushed towards him. Desperate, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red, as if it was a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long, gleaming, and on his helm was a crown. In one hand he held a long sword, and in the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with a pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. At that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground, and he heard himself crying, "O Elbereth Githaniel!" At this time, he struck at the feet of his enemy. A shrill cry rang out in the night, and he felt a pain like a dart of poisoned ice pierce his left shoulder. Even as he swooned, he caught, as through a whirling mist, a glimpse of Strider, leaping out of the darkness with a flaming brand of wood in either hand. With a last effort, Frodo dropped his sword, slipped the ring from his finger, and closed his right hand tight upon it. And that's how the chapter ended. Well, what do you got first?
Well, my goodness. One thing, as we said, finally, we've been so scared of this encounter for so many chapters and kind of fearing this moment, and it finally hit us. So all of a sudden, the Black Riders are there.
Right.
They
yeah.
saw him.
Yep.
They approached. They came over the hill. And I can't. It's hard to get a sense of how chaotic this is outside of Frodo's mind. But it seems like all hell is breaking loose.
Yeah. And so, like, it was kind of confusing because it was told from Frodo's perspective. Like, where I started reading, like, he was in, like, the, basically, like, kind of the Shadow Realm,
uh-huh.
like where he's wearing the ring, because then it's like, oh, the riders don't look like the dark cloaks, they look like white, you know, old kings,
right?
Basically,
right.
Which I think the movie did a good job of what they would look like.
So it's notable there. Is this the first description we've had of what Frodo sees when he puts on the ring?
It might be. I mean, this is the most noble thing of all. I mean, to the Black Riders, though, it's like, you know, of all the hype and lead up to it, it's like, wow, you know, this kind of lived up to it. It's like, this was really scary. They did exactly what Strider was hinting at. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. I kind of want to focus more, though, on Frodo, the lines about how he put on the ring.
Yes,
you know,
definitely.
So it's pretty notable that it's like, it's not really that Frodo's giving into temptation here, because he does kind of resist it. Like, Tolkien's being pretty explicit that it's like, he literally has no choice. Like, the ring has to be put on his finger. You know, and it's to the almost where it's like, that's not his will doing it.
Well, I would argue he is giving into temptation. It's just that, like, the temptation is ratcheted up. It's, like, turned up to a point that's so powerful that Frodo just, he doesn't have enough strength to push back against it.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody would have enough strength.
Right,
either.
Right.
Well, so that might not actually be...
I would still say that's giving in. He's still buckling under the load, basically.
Okay, but it's less of a knock against him.
Right, I'm not saying he's not...
A significant less of a knock
against him. Yeah. It's not that he's not heroic or trying hard or whatever, but it's a misstep.
Yeah, well, I mean, it also, like, not that Frodo's thinking about it in this situation right now, but if we think back to when he was talking with Gandalf in Chapter 2, mm-hmm. and they were talking about, like, the history of the ring and everything, and, like, Frodo, like, was very disgusted by Gollum, mm-hmm. it's probably moments like these where it's like, oh, he has, like, a newfound, not so much respect for Gollum, but, like,
understanding,
more empathy, yeah, of how he felt.
Right, like, if a force that strong, if you were experiencing a force as strong as what I just experienced, I could understand why you would put it on.
We've heard about Elbereth before from Gildor. This is probably another one of those Marian references,
mm-hmm.
like the Hail Mary, you know?
Yes.
Not just like the football play, but it's like, yeah, reach out, any help
right.
you can get.
And for a quick refresher, what did Gildor say about Elbereth?
Well, she's like the queen of the star and like the most beloved for all of them.
For all the elves.
By all elves, mm-hmm. yeah. And
so
they sang the whole song, and the whole song was basically like the Ave Maria or Salve Regina.
Right.
You know, like just think of that, and that's what they were singing.
And what's Gilfaniel? Is that...
That's one of her titles. Okay, okay. I forget exactly what it means. I should know.
But... So, can we speculate here that Elbereth is, like, the sort of the brightest of all stars, or whatever you might say, whatever her epithet might be, that that's, like, a source of light in a time of darkness, and maybe a literal light exposed to the literal darkness of these Black Riders?
Well, she is a person, but she did create all the stars.
So... Frodo, knowingly or not, is reaching out to his best approximation of the opposite of these Black Riders.
Yes.
Okay.
And he's not just... Well, we'll talk about it a little bit more at the end. He's not just saying the words, just to say them.
Okay.
All right, but let's actually talk about these Black Riders, because now we probably fully know them at this point, or pretty close. We're almost there.
Yes.
Or as much as, maybe we're not, because I know the whole
story. Okay, more might be coming.
We know a great deal more than we did last chapter.
So what we got from this chapter, at the start, Fatty Bulger saw black shadows creeping through his yard.
Yeah.
Almost slithering or crawling.
Right.
That sounds to me like something not so human, not so humanoid.
Well, let's actually, I know this will take a while, but I kind of want to just like actually go through, like, let's lay out like a lot of the details that we have about him for chapter 10 and for this. So like the last chapter when Aragorn was talking about him, and then this one too. So from chapter 10, Strider had been talking at one point. He said, you will have to leave the open road after tonight, for the horsemen will watch it day and night. You may escape from Bree and be allowed to go forward while the sun is up, but you won't go far. They will come upon you in the wild, in some dark place where there is no help. Do you wish to find them? They are terrible. And Strider also said they come from Mordor.
From Mordor, Bali man, if that means anything to you.
Yeah. And then there was the incident with Merry where he had said, suddenly I shivered and felt that something horrible was creeping near. There was a sort of deeper shade among the shadows across the road, just beyond the edge of the lamplight. It slid away into the dark without a sound. There was no horse. He said, I thought I had fallen into deep water. Strider told him it was the black breath.
Okay. Okay.
Strider goes on. He says, they're not all here. Well, this is still in chapter 10.
Yeah. They might not attack the inn. I think. Mary says, will they attack the inn? No, I think not. They're not all here yet. And in any case, that is not their way. In dark and loneliness, they are strongest. They will not openly attack a house where there are lights and many people. Not until they're desperate. Not while all the leagues of Eriador still lie before us. But their power is in terror, and already some in Bree are in their clutch. They will drive these wretches to do some evil work.
Right. So then, yeah, like what you were saying with the fatty section. So it's notable, the Black Shadows, there's a sense of dark hopelessness and fear. And then they come in the name of Mordor. Like, they literally say it themselves. And then, yeah, with the rooms in Bree, you know, they attack the rooms, but nobody had heard them. And so, like, they are silent and stealthy, which is notable. Then there was that one part that we were talking about when Mary was asking, can they see? You know, because it seemed like they were sniffing around the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And Strider says, the black horses can see, and the riders can use men and other creatures as spies, as we found at Bree. They themselves do not see the world of light as we do, but our shapes cast shadows in their minds, which only the noon sun destroys. And in the dark they perceive many signs and forms that are hidden from us. Then they are to be feared most. And at all times they smell the blood of living things, desiring and hating it. Senses, too, there are other than sight and smell. We can feel their presence. It troubles our hearts. As soon as we came here and before we saw them, they feel ours more keenly. Also, the ring draws them.
Strider goes on, we read this already, but Sauron can put fire to his evil uses, but these riders do not love it and fear those who wield it.
Right. Just like some key lines that we already hit when we were reading that whole attack scene. It said they felt rather than saw a shadow rise.
So black were they that seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them.
Then Frodo, when they're coming up, he said he was quaking as if he was bitter cold, but the terror was swallowed up in a hidden temptation to put on the ring. The desire, this is more about the ring. Actually, let's not read that part.
Okay. When he has the ring on, the shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. And then also with the ring on, in their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Patrick read this earlier. So those are some snippets over the past two chapters that hopefully give you a sense of what we've gathered about the Black Riders so far. They definitely sound pretty terrible. But to be more specific, some sort of like dark ghost creature in a cape riding a horse. The horse sounds pretty animate. As for these creatures themselves, what do we make of them? Are they animate? Do they have flesh or form?
So I think the deal is, and we haven't quite covered it yet, but there is the one, also in this chapter, there was the part where Frodo and Aragorn and everybody, they were all walking, and then like they had to be conservative with their food because like they have to make it last. And so like they were all starting to feel like they were getting into shape and everything. And Frodo, he says, I hope the thinning process will not go on indefinitely or I shall become a wraith. And then Strider just immediately yells at him like, don't speak such things. Oh, what are you doing? You know? And so I guess we haven't actually had the word come up yet, but these Black Riders, they are the ring wraiths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I think we got to go in like, well, what's a wraith? You know, we gotta get into the details.
Yeah. Has this word come up yet or no?
I don't think it's actually come up, which it must be in the next chapter, but I got all the notes ready. I think we gotta do it.
Okay.
We gotta go for this.
Okay.
So these are the ring rays. Okay. So Wraith. No, I'm not gonna let you take guesses. We don't have time for guesses. So this comes from the Oxford English Dictionary. It says of obscure origin, which that instantly means this is Tolkien's favorite kind of word, okay? Because it's like,
yes.
Because that means he wants to go, in quotes, discover the meaning. And this was probably a topic of discussion for the Inklings at some point, because Lewis was notably interested in this too. Okay, so etymology of wraith. And it's like, okay, maybe we are screwing up because we haven't gotten to them. I'm sure they're going to mention it in the next chapter. If they don't there, then it's like, whatever. We have to have covered this. So we got to do this. So the etymology of wraith. So it comes from the Old English wraith.
Wraith?
Or wraith, yeah. And so from there,
you're saying the word W-R-I-T-H-E?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rive. Like you can. That's still a word in English. Like it means like you're twisting and contorting.
Oh, Clifford, I'm getting to that. Like, yeah. So from there we get our words. Yeah, I get it, Clifford. I'm about to say that.
Okay.
so we get our words. Wreath, which is something that's twisted. We get wrath and wrath, which are the adjective and noun forms for anger. So those actually seem kind of unrelated, like twisted and angered. But according to Tom Shippey, it says, the word is an old metaphor which suggests that wrath is a state of being twisted up inside. So that's how they kind of connect to each other.
Okay.
But yeah, wraith means to twist, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So now there's two actual definitions in the Oxford English Dictionary. So the first one is
for wraith.
An apparition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. An apparition or specter of a dead person, a phantom or a ghost. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's one. The second one is an immaterial or spectral presence of a living being. Okay. So that's like, I don't know. Those are kind of contradictory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then it also brings up the questions like, all right, well, are these guys alive? Are they like a material thing or are they like immaterial?
Well, I like that second definition. It sounds like they're not material, but they're directly linked to something that is or was.
Okay. Well, Shippey goes on to say, Tolkien's ring race, of course, answer all the questions posed and also demonstrate once more the apparent mistakes or contradictions in the old poems that may simply indicate an understanding that is the self-confident 19th and 20th century dictionary compilers had not reached. So he's going to just, in classic Tolkien fashion, he's going to have it be both definitions. Or at least his are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the most dominant thing that's going to happen, what's the most dominant word about these people that we already know?
Fear? Black?
No, not black. Come on.
Help me out.
Shadow.
Shadow? Okay.
Yes.
Shadow.
Wow, first try, Clifford. So, what do we know about them? These ones are, I think Gandalf's talked about this, but, and again, now we don't actually know their number directly. We're going to find out their number next chapter, but we are just going to slightly spoil it tonight. Sorry. Most of you have seen the movie, so whatever. Mm-hmm. There are 9 of these guys. What do you think they're connected to?
It brings to mind a poem that we read at the beginning of the book.
Why don't you say, I'm not sure. Just to
I'm not sure.
Okay, what if, Clifford, I gave you a hint and said, these Ringwraiths were once men?
Ooh, it brings to mind a poem that I read at the beginning of this book.
Yeah, okay, correct. Yeah, these are the 9 men that got the rings of power, the men's rings of power.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the book.
That's a big piece. 9 for the mortal men doomed to die.
But are they dead? They got these rings thousands of years ago. They should be dead by now.
Well, they're doomed to die. We don't know what that means. That might just mean mortal.
But what about here in the story? I mean, they're clearly alive here in the story because they're going around stabbing people.
yeah. I mean, like you said, I guess Tolkien's having his cake and eating it too. These things are both material and immaterial.
Right.
Maybe a bit like Tom Bombadil, interacting with the physical world, and yet they might be like spirits or something not quite real themselves. Or I should say very real, but not quite fully animate. Incarnated, maybe, is not a better word than animate.
Yeah, but they're also carrying stuff. Like, they're physically carrying stuff. Like, they're riding horses.
That's what I mean. It's like, you can't really put your finger on it.
Yeah, so I think it should be also mentioned, he says that they're kind of like smoke. Like, they're physical, and they're even dangerous because they can even choke you, you know? Like, smoke can choke you.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're effectively intangible.
I mean, even in science, like, light actually is a really weird thing like that. Like, you think about light is actually the same way. Light interacts with the physical world. Like, it can heat, specifically heat, but, like, light contains energy or is energy or whatever, and therefore can interact with matter, but light itself is not matter. That's a really weird concept in physics. That's kind of what's going on here, where these things are maybe...
Correct.
Light or lack of light. They're interacting with matter, people, swords, that type of thing, but they're not matter themselves, but they're clearly real and powerful.
Well, so instead of talking about light, we want to talk about shadows, which, that gets into the same thing here. So shadows, that have been very prevalent for this book. There was a chapter called Shadow of the Past.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the working title for a while for this book was just Shadow of the Past.
Oh.
In the Ring poem, you know, in Mordor, where the shadows lie. Mm-hmm. Sam's Gil-galad poem ends in Mordor, where the shadows are. Mm-hmm. Also, it's kind of notable that they're saying are there, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like, okay, so they do exist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
but Shippey goes on in his book series, says, one might think main associations of shadow are darkness or menace or perhaps oblivion. But the real point may be a more metaphysical one. Do shadows exist? It goes back to what we're talking about here. So then he thinks Tolkien's drawing from the Old English poem about Saruman and Saturn, which is a poem that poem, like, the most famous thing that goes on in it is, like, they have, like, a riddle game.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it, actually, during the Gollum riddle game, because that's where Tolkien got the idea for it. Of course. And, but one of the riddles that they ask in there, Saruman asks, what is that is not? And Saturn, you know, I guess it was clunkier in the original thing. I didn't read the original thing for this one, sorry. But apparently Saturn just answers, you know, in riddly ways, shadows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he gets to that. Because he's saying, like, they aren't a thing because they're just the absence of caused by another thing. You know, mm-hmm. like something's in your way, so it just causes the shadow.
Right.
But they are a thing because they have a shape and they have physical effects, like what you were saying. Like, it literally cools stuff down and it makes it dark. Like, you can't see in the shade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Absence can take on a kind of life and can become a presence. So this theme of shadows brings us to a really big theme in the books, and that's Tolkien's view of the nature of evil.
Interesting.
It kind of leads us to 2 options. So... the 2 options about the nature of evil, both are old, both are deep-rooted, both are still relevant, neither is easy to deny, but apparently irreconcilably in contradiction.
Okay. Complicated, but I'm ready for you.
So the first one comes from, it's the Boethian idea.
Okay.
All right, so this comes from this guy named Boethius, So he was like, he's kind of like represents almost like the Orthodox Christian view of this. Mm-hmm. Not like Orthodox with a small O, not capital O. So like just like correct Christian mm-hmm. view. And Lewis writes about it in his Mere Christianity, which is like his big, that's like his most famous like theological work,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is basically just a series of radio talks. And by mere, he just means like common. So it's like anything, like if you call yourself a Christian, you can
shared body yes. of Christianity.
Right. Yeah. And so this is the most famous example of this Christian thought here. And this comes from the Consolation of Philosophy, which is written by this Boethius guy.
Okay.
And so it's interesting because it's a Christian work, but it never mentions Christ or Christian doctrine because it just wants to use logic. I read this book for this episode specifically. Wow. It was like 100 pages, and it was a pretty good read. Kind of wordy because, you know, it's like so old, and then like yeah. whatever translation is really old. But here's the back cover of the book. And so this tells you about Boethius, who he was. Born in the late 5th century AD, Boethius was a Roman statesman and philosopher who would come into the service of the Ostrogothic ruler of Italy, Theodoric the Great. So this is like right after Rome has technically fallen, but they weren't aware of it at the time because it's like, whatever, that's a different subject. All right, mm-hmm. so end of the Roman Empire. Ultimately, he would rise to the position of Magister Officiorum, the head of all the government and court services. In 523 AD, he would find himself accused of treasonous correspondence with Justin I. I assume that's some emperor in the East. A charge that would land him in prison and ultimately lead to his execution. During Boethius's year-long imprisonment, leading up to his execution, he wrote The Consolation of Philosophy, a work that would become regarded as one of the most important and influential works from medieval times. The Consolation of Philosophy is a classical exposition of human nature as Boethius reflects on the treacherous betrayal that led to his fall from favor with his lord. In it, he ponders the universal question of theodicy, or why a benevolent and all-powerful God allows evil to manifest itself in the world, and on the transitory nature of fortune. Meant to provide himself with some solace in the face of his fated execution, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy is a work that has provided spiritual guidance to those in despair ever since its first appearance. This edition is printed on premium acid-free paper. Well, so that explains who this guy is. So it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. So,
let me just tell you, because I did read the book. So it's like, yeah, so it's weird because this guy's like clearly a Christian, but yeah, he does not mention like Christ at all in any way.
Okay.
And like I said before, he's trying to use logic to just prove everything.
Right.
So it's like you need God in the equation. So like they establish that. But then the whole story is like this beautiful woman as the personification of philosophy itself, and she's like literally consoling him like one night before he's gonna die and just explaining to him like, yeah, you did have a good life. And so Shippey goes on to say the Boethian view here, there is no such thing as evil. What people identify as evil is only the absence of good. Furthermore, what people in their ignorance often identify as evil things, like being under the death sentence being under the sentence of death, are in fact, and in the long run, or in the divine plan, to their advantage. Philosophy tells Boethius that all fortune is certainly good. The corollaries of this belief are that evil cannot create, and furthermore, it was not created. It arose when human beings exercised their own free will in withdrawing their service and their intentions from God. In the end, and when the divine plan has been fulfilled, all evils may be annulled, canceled, brought to good, as the fall of man was by the incarnation and death of Christ. And remember, this is written by the guy that's on death row,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is pretty admirable.
Yeah, it's impressive. You know,
that he takes this view.
So I'm gonna summarize it real quick from what I'm hearing. This view of evil is that evil is like shadow in that it is the lack of light. Light is good and evil is bad because it's the lack of the good thing. It's not a thing of itself, but it, you know, it just in the way that shadows are pretty tricky to pin down, it's a little tricky to pin down here. But it only exists because someone turned off the light because they had the choice to turn off the light.
Well, he's almost even saying it doesn't exist almost. Like, almost.
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like you could make a compelling argument that shadows don't exist.
Correct.
You're actually seeing everything around them.
Yeah.
They're just a lack of something.
Yeah.
And it's only in, like, mythology that they're given form. Or, like, personality or something right. like that.
Wait, well, yeah. Either way, again, it's still, like, extremely radical that this is coming from the guy that's falsely going to be executed, like executed on false grounds. I mean, that's insane. That he's like, yeah, evil. This isn't actually real. This is just you guys lacking good character, which is like, wow, noble dude. I got one more quote about it, and this one's actually from the direct, like, Consolation of Philosophy itself. So I think I might just dive into it, and like, we'll just see what we make of it. Okay. Whatever is must also be ontologically good, and it follows from this that whatever loses its goodness ceases to be. Thus, wicked men cease to be what they were. To give oneself to evil is to lose one's human nature. Just as virtue can raise a person above human nature, so vice lowers those whom it has seduced from the condition of men beneath human nature. For this reason, anyone whom you find transformed by vice cannot be counted a man, or in our case, a hobbit like Gollum, you know, or a ringwraith, which, you know, is an X-Man. The man who is driven by avarice is like a wolf. The restless man who spends his life in quarrels you will compare to a dog. The treacherous conspirator who steals by fraud may be likened to a fox. The man who is ruled by intemperate anger is thought to have the soul of a lion. The fearful and timid man who trembles without reason is like a deer. The lazy, stupid fellow is like an ass. The volatile, inconstant man who continually changes direction is like a bird. The man who is sunk in a foul lust is trapped in the pleasures of a filthy sow. In this way, anyone who abandons virtue ceases to be a man, since he cannot share in the divine nature and instead becomes a beast.
Very interesting.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. I think I have a sense of this view of evil. Why don't you give us some background on this competing view, and we can maybe it will illuminate some of the unique or different aspects of this first one.
Okay, so the second one is the Manichaean view, and so this one's gonna be like, it's gonna kind of be like a more potent / tangible one. But before we start, notably, do you know who the most famous ex-Manichaean is?
No.
That would be Saint Augustine.
Okay.
Who is also, actually, he was probably like 100 years before Boethius. Anyways, so Manichaeans, they come from Mani, who was a third century Persian sage who blended the teachings of Saint Paul with local ingredients to produce a cosmology and anthropology that accounted for every contingency of the universe and of each human life in terms of a constant struggle between primordial forces of light and darkness, good and evil. They reject the Old Testament because, so like one of the things about them, they reject the Old Testament because they couldn't envision a divine being who is perfectly good and just. So they couldn't reconcile the Genesis creation story. So like what eventually, you know, Augustine becomes like a huge Christian theologian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's one of the things that he does is, like, he really defends Genesis against the Manichaeans.
Interesting.
Like, I'm learning this all from, like, the Confessions of St. Augustine. This is, like, from the opening intro of whatever version I have. But it says, this guy was talking, he said, to be a Manichaean was to know that there was, in fact, no accidents in the world, that everything in nature could, so to speak, be scientifically explained. It was also to be confident in one's own life. As soon as one became the member of the elect, or the superior Manichaean cadre, he was to be on the light side.
Hmm.
So, light and darkness, good and evil, sounds a lot like
Star Wars?
Yeah, that's my thought, too. Yeah, dark side and light side of the Force.
Yeah, but also, I mean, this type of view comes up a lot in mythology, I think. And it's
And
other religions, I think that's something that's very, maybe it's a little bit easier for people to understand right off the bat, is good versus evil.
Right, so it's dualist.
Yeah. I guess it comes up in stories a lot, too, like things like Star Wars or like whatever it is, action movies or something, you have a good guy and a bad guy. You have good versus evil. And both are forces competing.
Now the key with Manichaeanism, though, and this is one of the reasons that it's basically like it was like an early heresy of the church, was because these people believe, and all dualists believe, I think to be a dualist you have to believe this, is no matter what kind you are, is good and evil are equal forces.
Mm-hmm. Equal and opposite reactions, or whatever.
Yeah. Which is, like, that cuts against the Christian view. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, like, what he was saying. Like, they can't accept Genesis because God created everything good at the beginning. And he's all good, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, they had to reject it. They just had to. Which, that kind of brings us to Weathertop here, where, you know, this goes back to what I was saying with Frodo. You know, he didn't have a choice when he put on the ring. Like, this evil force made him put it on. You know, right, made him... Right. I guess, give in to temptation there.
Right.
You know?
And in this view, maybe shadows are shadows with presence. Or maybe shadows is not even the right word, but the Black Riders are part of this force of darkness, which is against the force of light, presumably, that Frodo is summoning when he yells out for Elbereth.
Right. Well, that's the other part to this, too, that I thought was, like, there's, like, power of words here. And, of course, Tolkien, all about words, right? But it's, like, yeah, words have power throughout this whole story. Like, we already saw in this chapter, open up in the name of Mordor is what the mm-hmm, race mm-hmm. said to Fatty, you know? And Aragorn is, like, chastising all the hobbits. But he's just like, hey, don't talk about that kind of stuff here. You know, like, this is not the place for evil talk, you know? Because it actually has, like, literal power going right. on there. Like, that's why he's saying it. It's not just to, like, get him into a bad mood. It's like... No. We can't have that kind of thing here. It's almost like spells.
Right.
You know, mentioning the names. Which, yes, that is absolutely what's most going on when Frodo's yelling, O Elbereth Githaniel, at the end.
Power of words summoning the equal and opposite light reaction to the dark force in front of him.
Yeah. I mean, the Manichaean one, though, I mean, it's like, are the forces of good and evil equal in this story? I think... We definitely have to keep reading because I don't know. I don't want to give it away now, but we'll be able to see more developments of that as we cover this
yes,
stuff.
Yes.
You know, but this also comes back to, it's like the Boethian one. It sounds like, wow, that's a really noble thought. Like, ah, evil is just like a thing that basically doesn't exist and it's so much lesser mm-hmm. and everything. But for a guy that lived through World War I and then his sons fought in World War II mm-hmm. and he saw the whole thing, it's like, can you really, like anybody, like, I don't know. Maybe it'd be disrespectful to, like, roll your eyes, but it's like, you can't just do that when you live through the 20th century and you see right, all the devastation right. that happened. You know, it's like, that's not enough. So this Manichaean part becomes much more appealing to think, like, look at this evil, right, powerful right. force.
Yeah, and I would argue in the context of, like, Christian theology that we've been referencing a lot, that at various points in time... I think different writers or interpretations of Christianity, you may disagree with me, like, saying dualist, but maybe skew towards a dualist mindset. Like, the descriptions of, like, the devil as, like, the force, like, as, like, a being with force that is, like, set opposed to, like, a god that is good. And so you have, like, two forces competing against each other.
Well,
bad
so, I mean...
things come from, like, the force of the devil or something like that. I know that's maybe is like a not the most proper interpretation, but definitely I think that's something that people that comes up enough that people like understand that as a concept.
Well, I think writers can do what they want there, but then, you know, for Christianity, you know, but that's just each individually. But for Christianity as a whole, it's like, well, there's actual doctrine about evil. So some of the writers might call themselves Christian and then misinterpret it, but that's not actually like a representative view of Christianity's views on evil. I feel like Tolkien will get it right in this book, but we have to read further to see how it develops.
Okay.
We don't have enough information yet to like definitely solidly say something.
Well, so we had a lot in this chapter. We covered a ton of ground.
Yeah.
But key takeaways, the Black Riders have finally collided with the hobbits and Strider, and Frodo is in a dark place right now. We don't know where he's at the end of the chapter.
Yep. Well, he's stabbed.
He is stabbed. Things look pretty grim. The Black Riders themselves, we learned about them, and we discussed two different interpretations of evil that could be at play here in Tolkien's depictions of both the Black Riders and the world of Middle-earth more broadly. And yeah, I think that sets things up pretty well for going forward.
Exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Indeed, indeed.
All right, Clifford, got to do the end of this chapter here.
Yes.
How you been?
I've been good. Been busy as always. I feel like I'm moving a mile a minute, but things are good. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, it's good. Fun weekend. I did some cycling.
Sweet.
In the cold.
Sweet.
My feet froze.
Is it snowy there?
No, it was just really cold. And then, like, part of the snow didn't melt on, like, the one trail that I did, so I was going at it with, like, a road bike over ice and everything.
Sounds really safe.
I ended up, like, yeah, that got to the point where it's like, all right, I'm just going to cut off whatever parts I can of this trail. So, this was a long episode. This is the chapter 11, so we just talked about the Black Riders and, like, the two forms of evil.
Okay.
Yeah. Long one. Jeez. All right, I got a review here. So 5 stars. This is from Anne Marie 1251. And it's titled Changed My Life. This podcast is life-changing. If you need to know anything about Lord of the Rings, these are the guys to listen to. The deep insights that they give can't be found anywhere else. Nice. There we go.
Very nice. Makes me so proud.
Yeah, Anne-Marie 1251. Send me an email, and we'll get you a beer koozie. Everybody else,
what's the email for everyone's reference?
TalkingTolkienPodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you.
And keep checking out the Instagram to rate the characters, because this is gonna come into play at some point soon. So, all right, you got anything else for tonight? I guess this was already long.
Yeah, let's call it.
Alright, cool. Yeah, let's go for it. We got bigger stuff to do tonight.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, y'all. At last the sun is shining, the clouds are blue, oh why? With flames from the dragon of darkness, the sunlight flies.